Our next guest has written a roadmap for how workers, business, labor, education, and government can build high-quality jobs and strong and successful businesses through collaborative efforts. The new book is Shaping the Future of Work, a handbook for action and a new social contract. It is a call to action for building high-quality jobs and strong and successful businesses through collaborative efforts capable of overcoming the deep divisions all too apparent in society today. Thomas Calkin is the George M. Bunker Professor at the MIT Sloan School of Management and co-director of the Institute for Work and Employment Research, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Joel. I look forward to the conversation.
Give us an idea of why you felt a new social contract was necessary.
Well, it's very clear that the majority of American workers have not really experienced wage increase for a long period of time. Wages have stagnated really since the 1980s. And as the economy got stronger and as productivity grew, more and more of the gains to that growth went to the very top income earners in society and to capital rather than to labor. And so it's time now to say, how do we update our policies and practices so that workers can share in the gains of the economy as well as others?
So in that update, let's have a set a bar, if you will. What do we have right, and then what do we have wrong and need to change?
Well, we've had a robust growth in jobs since or at least since about 2014. It took a long time to get over the effects of the Great Recession, and we finally got back the number of jobs needed to make up for those that were lost and make up for those increases in the labor force. Sometime in the midsummer, about July 15th or so, we finally, a decade after the recession, got back to where we were. So job growth is robust. It continues to be robust right now. The labor market is getting tighter. We still have lots and lots of problems with long-term unemployed and so on. But that's probably the bright spot right now. There are more jobs being created than in the years just after the Great Recession.
So let's talk about those current employment policies. Just how out of date are they? Obviously, what we consider the typical worker when the New Deal labor and employment policies were created, much different than the typical worker of today.
Well, that's right. Those New Deal policies were designed for somebody who was working for a long time, maybe a full career, with a single employer, usually a large employer, somebody who was either a manager or a blue-collar worker, tended to be viewed as a man with a wife at home, thankfully taking care of family and community responsibilities and so on. Well, that's changed. Today we have a much more diverse workforce, men and women just about equally represented in the workforce today. We have people working in small firms and large firms as contractors, as independent contractors, as temporary employees. We have people moving around from one job to another because economic conditions change or because they prefer to move rather than try to change practices at their existing employer. And so we have a much more diverse workplace, much more diverse forms of work organization, and we have a much more diverse workforce. So we've got to change and update our policies that still assume we're back in the industrial age of the 1930s.
So how do you define a social contract and what ultimately that can what that can get us and where it can bring us?
We borrowed the concept of a social contract from political philosophers who used, like Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who used that term to identify what are the obligations of individual citizens to the state or to the government, and what's the reciprocal obligations of the government to its citizens. Well, we asked the same question about what happens in employment relationships. What are the expectations and obligations that we have for employers and that employers have for workers? In the period from the 1940s till 1980, we had a robust economic growth, we had rising productivity, and wages and benefits improved in tandem with that productivity. And so we got more and more people moving into the middle class, and we got incomes rising as the economy got stronger. That social contract broke down in the 80s, and as I said earlier, productivity continued to grow, but wages flattened out. And so that's why we see so much anger and frustration in society today, as it was reflected in the election and in other ways.
But it seems that that anger and frustration, there's nothing on the horizon that is going to change that, right? I mean, we're not doing anything proactively now to change that anger and frustration other than making a leadership change.
Well, that's right. Unfortunately, there's no progress on this, certainly not from Washington at the moment. But I think we will only change this when the public itself, workers and their families and local leaders, begin to take action and say enough is enough, and really begin to ask for the kinds of policy changes and demand the kinds of policy changes that are needed to rebuild worker voice, to rebuild worker bargaining power in our economy. As unions have declined, the workers have lost their voice and their ability to influence what goes on and what their conditions of work are. We've got to change that. We've got to encourage employers to compete on the basis of what we call the high road, that is, high productivity, innovation, engaging employees so that they become more productive, training employees so that they can afford to pay a higher wage, as opposed to just treating labor as a cost that has to be minimized and controlled and kept from having any voice at work. So we need those kinds of changes are possible. We can do it in this economy if we put our minds to it and we start working together.
Can you give us some real-world examples as to taking the high road versus taking the low road?
Well, the most frequently used comparison is Walmart as a low-road employer that, you know, emphasizes low prices, but it gets low prices by keeping its wages low at a minimum, keeps its staffing uncertain and called in as needed. It has low tenure employees. People come and go. It keeps unions out by suppressing any efforts to organize or to gain a voice in the organization. And it's quite profitable. It gives good returns to its share owners, but it produces very poor quality jobs. Compare that to Costco, and Costco also emphasizes low prices, but it also emphasizes customer service, and it has much better customer service ratings, and it gets that by investing in its employees, by making sure that they're well-trained, that they stay with the organization over time, that they're more productive because they know how the business operates and they can solve more customer service problems, and therefore they pay higher wages. And so here's a company that competes. It also, with Walmart, it also gets very good shareholder returns, and it provides good jobs. So businesses have a choice in how they compete, and we need more firms that take the high road rather than the low road. We can find them in other industries. Southwest Airlines would be the example, perhaps, in the airline industry. Kaiser Permanente, maybe in the healthcare industry. Here in the Northeast, we saw an example with Market Basket a few years ago, which was threatened from its role as a high road firm because the share owners, the family owners, felt they need to pull more money out of it, and the workforce revolted. And as you know, the workforce and the customers supported the workforce, and that coalition forced Market Basket owners to maintain the kind of policies that they have in place.
You have a graph with the key elements in high road and low road business strategies. Two that struck me, one being the employee attachment to the company, which are extensive in high road business strategies. And the other one, which I found really interesting, is employee voice, that whether it's informal or formal, that there are options for engagement and there is representation and the importance of that.
That's right. There's no substitute for an engaged workforce. And typically, we get employee voice through union representation. But even in a unionized setting, you have to have a partnership between labor and management. You can't have just a traditional adversarial or arm's length union management relationship to get to the levels of productivity and quality service and quality jobs that we're talking about. They have to work together, and there are examples of that. And then there are examples in the non-union setting too. I mentioned Market Basket. There are organizations in various service areas. There's a fascinating organization in New York that's a cleaning service, an office cleaning service called Managed by Q, where there's an enormous amount of engagement of the workforce in finding new ways to provide services to the offices that are the organization's customers and clients. And so the workforce itself is engaged in helping to support the business. So there are different ways to achieve it, but there's no substitute for employees feeling secure enough to raise their voices when they feel something isn't being done right. And to use their collective voices to improve operations and customer service.
At the risk of being accused of leading the witness, let me ask the question as a follow-up to what I just asked you. A lot of these things seem as though, A, they make common sense, and B, they don't cost the company a lot.
Well, they don't cost the company a lot once they're in place.
Right.
Let's take Walmart. Suppose Walmart wanted to move from the low road to the high road. Well, it would have to invest a lot in training and development, and it would have to change its corporate culture to one of embracing employees as partners, to listening to them, to allowing them to find their own voice, whether that's a union or some other form. Those are investments. And those are investments that have costs in the short run and get benefits in a little bit longer run time frame. So the movement from the low road to the high road might be costly, but once one's there, you get significant benefits from it. And that's one of the reasons we don't see enough of this. There's not enough pressure on businesses like Walmart to move to the high road. We need workers to put more pressure, and we need customers who say, look, like at Market Basket, we value a company that treats its employees well. We value a company that has long service employees who know us and who will work with us and help us when we need customer assistance. So the customers themselves and the society and the community need to be calling for more high road firms.
Final question, and it's a two-parter, which is the name of the book is Shaping the Future of Work. So ultimately, what do you see that shape as of how do we know that we've achieved it? And the second part of that, which is key, which is how optimistic are you that we can achieve that?
Well, I'm optimistic that a lot of people share these concerns. The vast majority of the American public wants to see our businesses do better by their employees as well as by their customers and share owners. That's very clear, and that's what gives me optimism. To get there, though, we're going to have to really mobilize society. I'm not optimistic about anything going on in Washington at the moment. Actions are being taken to go in the wrong direction. They're taking away safety and health protections. They're weakening rules governing unions. They're weakening a lot of the overtime protections that the Obama administration put in place. So we're lowering our labor standards in the current administration, and we're likely to see more deterioration in the short run. But I think we have to look beyond the current situation. We have to ask ourselves, what kind of society do we want, and how are we going to get there? And then those of us who teach the next generation of managers have to do our part to make sure that managers know that they have choices, that they know what it is that they can do to manage with high road policies, and to encourage them to think harder about that.
Tom Calkins' new book is Shaping the Future of Work, a handbook for action and a new social contract. The book is published by MIT Press. Tom, thank you very much for sharing with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Joe. Have a good day now.
Great pleasure. Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.